You're listening to the Mushroom Revival Podcast. Today on the show, we welcome Ron Shore, who has spent years studying clinical applications for psychedelic therapy and collecting related data.
Ron's background in public health and community-oriented benefit provide a much-needed perspective on the growing economy of psilocybin and other entheogens. Ron is also literate in neurophysics, so we discuss some of the juicy brain chemistry involved in psychedelic substances, especially our beloved psilocybin. So tune in to a relevant and valuable conversation on the ethos of psychedelic industry, as well as some cognitive science.
I'm Ron Shore, and I'm I have an interesting background and current position, so I'll give you a bit of a broad view overview. I'm a doctoral candidate at Queen's University, and I'm also a teaching fellow, so I've taught at Queen's for about 15 years. And I also teach at the University of Ottawa, part-time professor. My doctoral research is specific to the clinical application of psilocybin. And as part of my doctoral research, I do scoping reviews, which are an active knowledge synthesis to summarize what we know about psilocybin, given the rapid expansion and in the state of the science. It's a kind of important function. So, and I am an industry consultant. I have a background. I spent 25 years in community and public health, prior to the psychedelic work. And really, I came out of the AIDS movement and the harm reduction movement. So I started a needle exchange in our city in Ontario, Canada, here in the early 1990s. That grew into a large multi-program community health center, specifically for people who use injection and illicit drugs. So that's kind of my background. I got involved in psychedelic stuff through my teaching at Queen's. I teach drug studies, and obviously psychedelics are a fascinating molecule. Or molecules to teach, and then they kind of rose to prominence as a novel and possibly very efficacious treatment for mental health and addiction. So that got my interest even more, and that's what prompted my decision to go back and do a doctorate in this. I have a master's in health policy and a bachelor's in philosophy. But more recently, I got hired by a company called Dimensions Healing, to help start a series of retreat centers. They're very interested in psilocybin and other expanded states of consciousness and how we might be able to craft a program that is kind of customized to maximizing the power of set and setting and combining other modalities into a nature retreat setting and try to have kind of optimal healing gains. So I'm helping develop the kind of program design and the protocols for that, Dimensions Healing. So my title with them is Managing Director, Clinical Services, Policy, and Research for Dimensions Healing.
So I read when I was doing some research on you that you aim to combine neuroscientific and traditional ceremonial practices for psilocybin psychotherapy.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering if you could comment on this. I mean, obviously it makes a lot of sense from the patient's perspective, but, you know, coming at it from your perspective of providing the space, why do that and how are you doing that? How are you like developing the protocols or the all that?
Yeah, for sure. No, that's a great question. If you take a step back and you look at the evolution of kind of psychedelic literature and science, there's almost two distinct streams or paths. And one is the more contemporary kind of biomedical psychedelic assisted therapy, clinical trials. Really, there's a foundation in neuroscience that Robin Carhart-Harris at Imperial College and others have really helped to evolve a narrative that helps us understand the importance of brain connectivity. So that's kind of the clinical side and the neuroscientific side. We've really had a massive explosion in our ability to understand the nervous system in the brain over the last 30 years. The imaging technology available now far exceeds what we had 10, 15 years ago. So it's an exciting time to be in neuroscience. We're learning a lot about who we are and states of consciousness. The problem is these are issues that historically we've not done a great job with. We do a really poor job of understanding drugs and drug effects, and there's an enormous stigma and obviously criminalization there. And we don't really have a lot of comfort around notions of spirituality or consciousness and who we are really in terms of fundamental identity. And there's been obviously a kind of spiritual chasm and rift in a lot of parts of the developing world as people seek a return to nature, that kind of thing. So the neuroscience is fascinating in terms of even the benefits of forest therapy, the benefits of kind of moving people into the parasympathetic nervous system as opposed to the sympathetic nervous system, that fight or flight. And the problem in contemporary culture is this massive overstimulation that we all suffer from as a result of advanced industrial kind of technological capitalism, screen time, productivity, you know, social conflicts, those things. So I think the neuroscience neuroscientific side just shows us a way that we can kind of improve our health based on real measurements and real insights. And so that's exciting. So that's kind of the one stream of psychedelics. And that's really what's pushing, you know, say MAPS and the MDMA trials, the fascination with psilocybin that's come out of largely Carhart-Harris's work and Johns Hopkins and all the trials. So that's legitimate and bona fide and super interesting. The other side to the equation that often gets forgotten that I'm particularly interested in is more of the cultural and anthropological lineage. So what is it about the human fascination with psychoactive molecules? I think we can, it's fairly well established that in terms of human history, really back to Neanderthal times, we've had a conscious relationship on a ritualistic basis with psychoactive plants like cannabis and opium. And ergots that would have occurred in infected grain, psilocybin, amanita. So all these things is a rich human history. And for those of us kind of in the West wondering our lineage, you just have to go to ancient Greek culture to realize that, you know, the luminaries of Western thinking, Plato, Aristotle, Pythagoras, all of these gentlemen got the benefit of participating in the Eleusinian mysteries that went on for close to 2,000 years. And really, it's at the foundation even of Christianity. So without getting too much into that stream, more recently, people from the West and the Northern Hemispheres have been interested in kind of plant medicine, whether it's the forest medicine of ayahuasca or the kind of mushroom journeys that came out of the Mazatec region in Mexico. And we need to understand culturally the lineage of those, understand the importance of the relationship of those plants and those modalities to the cultures which we need to protect. So you almost have this chasm emerging in psychedelic research between the scientific model that is verging towards, let's get these drugs approved so we can prescribe them. It's the new psychiatry. Then you have another stream, which is more looking at the importance of psilocybin, mushrooms, all of these other kind of psychedelic or entheogenic plants and the relationship to culture and spirituality. When you look on that side, you realize that plant medicines have always been used communally within group settings. A huge part of the purpose of these kind of traditions was to inculcate or strengthen a certain cultural worldview within their communities, bond teenagers to the elders, that kind of thing. And I'm concerned that the Western model, if it goes really psychiatric or medical or patent pharmaceuticals, it's not honoring the medicine, and it's going to really limit the gains we can have if we took a more cultural approach and we look at community and we build solidarity and it's about relationships to each other. So what I mean when I'm talking about blending the neuroscientific and kind of the group ceremonial is first of all, be very mindful of cultural appropriation. We need to understand and present our lineages. We need to recognize the genocide and the history of colonialism when it comes to these plants. So really, any group getting started in this field, I think your first step needs to be honor and recognize that. And then kind of declare and find your own lineage and how you fit into this without appropriating other cultures. But the more recent kind of scientific literature coming out of Imperial College looks at the experience of group psilocybin retreats like Synthesis Institute in the Netherlands. And what we're finding is that people who sit in ceremony together have added benefits because of the experience of communitas. We're all struggling for belonging. So that's that notion of the importance of social solidarity, togetherness, realizing we are connected to each other and obviously to nature. And so I'm interested in combining the neurological, but doing it more in a group setting and looking at building community. I come from a community health background. So to me, it's always about people's connections, their sense of belonging. So I think it's just the, you know, where things are at in terms of the evolution of psychedelics. I think everyone's realizing individually in terms of psychological benefit, there's an application, but then the larger issues have to do with decriminalization, legalization, people growing mushrooms, people using them. How do we use them, you know, with respect and with benefit and really reducing the adverse experiences and the known risks. And that's a huge part of what my doctorate is on.
Thanks for saying that. And I, you know, obviously it's very complex, and obviously cultures all around the world have been using these entheogens for thousands and thousands of years. And currently, especially in North America, there seems to be this shroom boom. And it is a renaissance, you know, again, from the 60s of this sudden mass interest of, you know, psilocybin and these other entheogens. What are your thoughts on the growing economy of psilocybin therapy and the good, the bad, and the ugly? And I know you touched upon it in what you just said, but on the economic side of it, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, no, Alex, you're definitely honing in on probably the most critical issue in terms of moving forward in this kind of space. And I was fortunate. When I taught at University of Ottawa last fall, I had a woman participating in our class who was a 70-something-year-old psychedelic kind of pioneer and therapist out of San Francisco. And she was greatly helpful to me in kind of understanding where we're at now compared to, say, late 60s, early 70s. And what she would say, and it's Maria Mangini, who's founder of the Women's Visionary Council and mm-hmm. has done terrific work in psychedelics. I think she was actually part of Leary's kind of commune in Upper New York State at one point. So she's a remarkable woman, lots of great kind of writings on this. But what she talked to me about a lot was that the matrix is different now. So, and what she means by that is the cultural beliefs, how interested and what the level of awareness is in terms of popular culture, of the benefits possibly of entheogens and how we're defining them. So I think the big difference now compared to early on in the kind of 60s and 70s is A, we've learned the lesson from those times, and then B, culture's changed. We have a much more progressive culture in terms of awareness of social justice issues, equity issues. We've got a long way to go. But for me, psychedelics as a totally new industry and a totally new sector, this is the kind of litmus test for what kind of values we want to have as an industry. What are the operating principles? How do we act? How do we behave? And combine the fact that we're talking about sacred medicine here. So you have an added sense of honor and respect we need to uphold, let alone recognizing issues of indigenous reciprocity. So I think, you know, the North Star Pledge and companies kind of looking at making values and ethics pledges is a start. But my concern, obviously, is if there are efforts to, and I'm sure you know this, to patent psilocybin or various compounds. There was an attempt to patent ayahuasca about 20 years ago. And we need to realize these are culturally protected, important plants that have a cultural significance that, you know, we can't ignore, and it would be extractive colonialism to do that. So that's my biggest concern. And I think as much as I study the clinical trials and love the advancement of the medicine and the science, we have to realize clinical trials are designed to advance regulatory drug approval. So even in my case, when I'm looking at, you know, the 11 clinical trials that I study really intensively, which are the psilocybin trials for clinical benefit in a range of disorders from substance use to end-of-life distress to obsessive compulsive disorder to treatment-resistant depression. My favorite trial is the one for long-term or demoralization among long-term kind of AIDS patients or people with HIV/AIDS in San Francisco. It's a really excellent trial. They were more inclusive, so they brought more people in and they didn't screen out people in a way that a lot of clinical trials do in order to get really good outcomes. And in terms of publishing their results, they're really honest about how hard it was and the struggles when you actually bring people in who have bipolar disorder and you're treating with psilocybin. The gains are there, but it's more work than if you're looking at people who don't have a complexity or comorbidity. And a lot of the trials really focus on older people, white people, professionals. They do very well. They get 12 hours of kind of preparation and integration afterwards. So there, my question is, if you're going to learn from that and then incorporate it in kind of mainstream culture, the science is behind the practice, meaning this massive explosion due to the economic interest is driving a surge of new clinics and treatment modalities and new treatment protocols that is probably ahead of the science. And I don't say that that's it's a negative, because I think that's where change happens. And really, science tends to be, you know, but there's about a 10-year gap. That's why it's remarkable, even just like the evolution of vaccine development so rapidly during COVID. Generally, science takes a lot more time. So I think for me, the concern is if we're going to learn from the science and learn from the cultural histories and then adapt that and modify it into a contemporary setting with real people, what are we doing? What are the values? What's the profit motive? And again, for me, the nice thing about my work with Dimensions is when I talk to them about Indigenous reciprocity and I talk to them about equity and inclusion, from a corporate level, the belief and the support is there. I think people realize we need to do things differently as an industry, but there's so much happening right now. I say this is a really contested space right now. The language hasn't really settled on what we're doing. And, you know, we know who the major players are, but I'm not quite sure how this will all settle. So my concern is, obviously, if you look at the history of capitalism, we know what the risks are. And if you look at the history of big pharma, we know what the risks are. So I think we just need to make sure that the psychedelic sector it stays grassroots, community-based, people-centered, and really looking at these as an opportunity for healing pathways. I don't think entheogens are a silver bullet, but they do give us, they open a door, they open a significant portal to understanding a different sense of life and reality and who we are and our connection with people. But afterwards, that requires support and integration and ongoing community dialogue and And I think for me, I think the companies that will rise above are the ones who truly understand the cultural issues, the population health-based issues, aren't looking for short-term profit, aren't looking for new patents, but are really motivated by a sense of betterment for everyone. And you know, I come from the public health sector where I worked with people who had severe chronic multiple addictions and homelessness. And the reality is, for those of us who do psychedelic research, it's really hard to get public funding. I'm someone who, prior to all of my PhD funding applications, I always had great success in funding applications. And talking to other graduate students across Canada anyways, we can't get funding for psychedelic-assisted research from the standard silos. So what that does is it creates an opportunity for the private sector to fund really good research in science early and look at really good program development as a way of helping to expand this treatment, which will eventually kind of, I think, filter more into kind of publicly managed and publicly kind of funded. But I think right now we're just developing the whole modality. And the interest is predominantly coming from people in the private sector and a lot of people who came out of the cannabis industry and kind of learned the lessons from that are now driving the psychedelic kind of growth. And so it's a super interesting time. So I'm not opposed to the notion of private companies. Obviously, I'm getting involved with one because I believe that we can do good work there. But I think it just comes down to a matter of ethics, value, vision, how you're defining what you're doing, how you're setting up your programs and kind of what your relationships are with the larger world.
Absolutely. And it's heartwarming to see these two sides kind of approaching one another, you know, the grassroots, the homelands, the communal settings, and then the private sex and the companies. And it's encouraging to me because the mushrooms itself, that seems to be embedded in the lessons. I'm enthusiastic and I'm optimistic about it. Do you have any bullet point practical things that people in this space can do if, say, someone who was once in the cannabis industry is listening to this and they want to get involved in psilocybin and be really careful and acknowledge these communities and all, yeah. You know, all of that. Do you have people that you talk to, books to read?
Great. Yeah. Great questions. I would say, first of all, Lyra, people should do their own work. I think doing your own shadow work is really important in the psychedelic sector. Honesty and transparency, I think, are our core values. People will only align with you if they believe in what you're doing and you're sitting true to the medicine. So I think, first of all, we all need to do our own work, whatever our practice is, whether it's meditations or we're participating in entheogenic rituals or we're doing mindfulness, whatever that is, yoga. People need to be doing their own therapy. We need to be coming to terms with our own shadow, because whatever we bring into this space is going to be magnified. And if you want to bring these medicines to new people, we need to make sure our container is kind of clean. And that takes a lot of work. So that's the first thing. I would say, secondly, the work should always be guided by your relationship to the medicine. That's how I got involved in this community. And that's how I got involved in the opportunity I'm involved in now, is just by sitting in medicine circles with people or doing work with people and really being part of understanding what's different about this space. And then building networks, and networks really depend. And that's how the brain works. That's how ecology works and mycelia works. Networks are decentralized. They're sharing. There's reciprocity. So I think, as long as, you know, we're operating knowing that we're part of something much larger than us. This is a wave kind of working through society that I think none of us really have, well, we certainly don't have control over, and none of us has a perfect perspective because we're just too limited in our view, and entheogens teach us that. So we need to trust in the medicine. We need to trust in ourselves. That comes back to being in a place of integrity all the time, as much as you can. So I think it's a sector I would like to see slow down a little bit and be really thoughtful and mindful about how we're doing it, bring in the right people. And that's been a neat thing about, for me, working with Dimensions, is being able to bring in Indigenous consultants, healers who do different kind of paradigms and modalities, and try to combine those with psychedelics so that we have an optimal kind of outcome. And for me, a lot of it is designing the flow of a retreat center. Like, what are you doing with people when they get there, and why? And that should all be backed up with science and understanding the psychedelic literature. So I think people need to do their homework and do their reading. And so for me, a huge influence for me is Francois Bourzat. So you may know her book, Consciousness Medicine. They have a new school of consciousness medicine to kind of expand some of her teachings. I think if people really want to understand mushrooms, I think Francoise probably got the strongest, truest voice. And I'm fortunate to be able to kind of get to talk with her once in a while and kind of help me in kind of my path in this. And obviously, you know, I think popular media, I think the Michael Pollan book, How to Change Your Mind, opened a lot of doors for people. And I think I've liked Michael Pollan's work for a long time. He wrote a book on drugs called The Botany of Desire, probably 15 years ago. That's really good. So I've taught from that book for quite a while at university. So I was pleased with his new book. I think it's a simplification. And the biggest concern I have is sometimes the popular media make it look like every time you take mushrooms, you're going to see God. or you're going to have some sort of overwhelming, mind-blowing, transformational experience. And we know that's possible. We know that's possible. And that's kind of what we're, that's the message of the medicine to some degree. But it also isn't always, we have a quick fix kind of attitude. I think a lot of people want healing quickly or a connection to God quickly or some sort of reconnection. And it takes more work than that. And I think the medicine teaches us that. So I think for me, Paul made it look a little easier than the work actually is. So I think for people to really just do some deep reading, there's the history of, you know, for me, I learned a lot from the history of ayahuasca scholarship, kind of came out of, you know, South America. I think Chacruna is an amazing kind of organization and website for probably the most insightful kind of current kind of commentary on what's happening in psychedelics. And then, you know, for me, it's understanding the traditions and the ancient history of these. So I think people can read widely, read deeply. There's lots on mushrooms and mycology. There's lots on tree and tree communication. There's lots on the importance of retreat and stepping away from mainstream society on at least a time-limited basis so you can reset your nervous system, reset your thinking. Because we're all so caught up into these rigid, hyperactive patterns that really limit our experience of life. And, you know, that's really just a matter of, you know, people trying to open to the fact that this normal operating everyday consciousness that we've been raised in and society encourages us to operate on a daily basis is just one form of consciousness. There's multiple others, and you only have to get into the woods or sit by a great body of water and you feel something different. And I think just really developing a literacy around those experiences. And so, you know, histories of mysticism are important to understand. The yoga philosophy, deep kind of sense of non-dualism, all of that. Alan Watts is one of my favorite writers, anything like that. I think there's so many amazing writers in this area. Marlene Dobkin de Rios is probably one of my favorite writers, and she's an early ayahuasca scholar. So she's, I think, got a really good insight into some of the nature of these experiences. So, and listening to wonderful podcasts like yours. I mean, there's so much people can tune into now that it's not for lack of information. We just need to go looking.
So just to go on more of a scientific front of breaking down specifically psilocybe cubensis, which a lot of people use in this space, has there been much research on the effects of, you know, different molecules present, right? From psilocybin versus psilocin versus norpsilocin versus norbaocystin, and then all the beta carbolines that are popular now. Has there been much research into that, or is it just specifically, you know, psilocybin pure isolated compound, and if you're lucky, the full mushroom itself?
Great question, and I love hearing you discuss all the other alkaloids, particularly in the whole organic biomass. So I guess short answer is there's some science, there's not enough yet, but I think that's the future. Particularly on the biological side, in terms of understanding the pharmacological potential of the whole biomass of not just psilocybe mushrooms, but all the other functional mushrooms that I know that you folks are understand and appreciate. So we're really just beginning on that. So I would say there's not a robust body of literature on that. Part of what we do as part of my doctorate is we're looking at all the animal studies as well using psilocybin. I have ethical concerns about animal studies. I'm not doing them, but I want to understand the literature and what they found. And there's some really interesting things that suggest the whole biomass has greater benefits than using synthetic psilocybin alone. All of the clinical trials, just to acknowledge, use synthetic psilocybin. That was, you know, psilocybin was originally synthesized by Albert Hofmann based on some mushrooms brought back by Wasson, which were taken without consent, really, or full informed consent or understanding from Maria Sabina. That created an enormous issue for Sabina and the Mazatec. She had her house burned. There was all sorts of difficulties in the community. So that we need to acknowledge that was an act of expropriation. So our knowledge of psilocybin kind of comes from that. So I don't think we can improve our relations with Indigenous people until we understand and acknowledge those pivotal points in history. So, but psilocybin synthetically, from my understanding, and I've not used it, but talking to people who have, say it's very comparable as an experience, but I can't vouch for that. And I'm much more interested in the entourage effect of all the other alkaloids you mentioned, much like with cannabis. It's the combination of the different kind of chemicals that create this kind of holistic experience. And I would rather go to the natural medicine, but I think, you know, we're also rediscovering Amanita. And I know Kevin Feeney's done some really neat stuff to try to get us to revisit Amanita. And there's companies now looking looking at the benefits of Amanita. So I think the mushroom world is just about to explode in terms of understanding the nootropic benefits of all these different chemicals and all of these different organic compounds, because really we're returning to understand our true pharmacological storehouse is nature, and it's our relationship to nature where we're going to find healing. So I'm excited where all that will go, but the synthetic psilocybin has definitely been what all the trials focus on. So I don't think that means the trials aren't generalizable to the whole mushroom, but I think there's added benefits with using the whole mushroom. And even if you look at just Mazatec traditions, they would eat them in pairs. There's a way of understanding and appreciating the spirit of the medicine that is a little bit lost when you're looking at a capsule, but you can still kind of understand at least that most of our pharmaceuticals and capsules really are derived from nature. And it's about time we kind of understand the roots of some of the medicine. So I think that'll really expand and explode in the next 10 years.
Yes. And you yourself have studied what you call the neurophysics of psilocybin. And, you know, from the few people that we've talked to about this, we don't really understand consciousness scientifically. So it's like, how do we hope to explain changes in consciousness, you know? But what can you say about like the physiological differences in the presence of psilocybin? And if you could also allude to doing one macro dose session versus microdosing over a period of time, like, do you notice any differences?
For sure. No, those are super good questions. So first of all, in terms of understanding the neurological changes that occur as a result of these entheogenic, or, you know, it's in the case of psilocybin and magic mushrooms, we're talking about serotonergic agonists. So, you know, chemically, it's related to LSD and DMT. So we're looking at and mescaline, although that's a slightly different in terms of chemical structure and has more of an amphetamine component, but they all have certain things in common. And one of the things they have in common is this kind of mechanism of action on the brain.
So quick aside here, since this episode was recorded, there was a study released by Yale University on July 5th that showed a single dose of psilocybin can increase the density and size of dendritic spines, which are like protrusions on a neuron. You can think of them like the very tips of roots, or perhaps more appropriately, like the hyphal tips protruding from a rhizomorph. So this increase in size and density was recorded in the frontal cortex of mice, which is not human, but it is mammalian. While so much still needs to be investigated about this, the standing evidence for neurogenesis occurring thanks to a dose of psilocybin has a lot more weight for it than against it. And if you are curious about this, we've linked the publication in the show notes, as well as a few other related articles. So be sure to check that out.
So here we need to obviously honor the work of Robin Carhart-Harris, who's probably the leading neuroscientist in this field. And he's got a couple key concepts that he's been introducing over the last really 10 years. So if you're interested in reading more, Carhart-Harris's work is dense, but he creates a narrative. And one of the things that's interesting is understanding the brain is so complex, but people are fascinated now with the brain more than they were even a couple years ago, because neuroscientists have given them some tools for making sense of it. So there's a narrative we're overlaying it to make sense of this unbelievable combination of billions of neurons and interconnections we do not understand. And, you know, there's considerable debate whether consciousness is even generated in the brain. There's considerable arguments that say consciousness is external, that somehow we just kind of tune into it. And that changes the notion of self and brain. But what Carhart-Harris has done is introduced some really key concepts that I think are worth building on. And one is this notion of the entropic brain. And he's got papers on this. He really builds on previous work by another neuroscientist named Carl Friston. And what Friston said is that the brain is a predictive machine. Essentially, we're constructing our experience of the present by looking at all the probability and the spread of data inferences from our past, and then making a construction which predicts our reality, because the reality is we're overwhelmed by sensory input. So we need to kind of decide what we gate and how we form perception and how we form concepts. So this notion of a predictive brain is such that you predict the future based on your past. So you can see there that the brain in many ways is constructing reality. So Carhart-Harris takes that notion, which is again Carl Friston. It's called the free energy principle, which is that the brain operates with such massive consumption of glucose and oxygen that it really looks to simplify. And it looks to simplify from a biological perspective what we perceive and how we interact by giving us certain kind of standardized structures of understanding reality. So what psychedelics do is they blow that apart. And that creates a condition of what Carhart-Harris would call entropy, or uncertainness, or randomness. So if you think about someone's macrodose experience and you've taken anywhere from, you know, gram and a half to 5 grams of psilocybe mushrooms, generally in the coming up period, one of the most common side effects and the most noteworthy adverse experience from the clinical trials is what we call transient anxiety and distress. As people's sense of perception of the world, their sense of self, their sense of reality, what to do, how to behave, falls apart because of the neurological actions of the molecule, which I'll explain in a minute, you have this kind of anxiety that can rise. And we know that the single leading preventable harm associated with psychedelics, which is the bad trip, is preventable through preparation, proper attention to setting, guidance through this experience. And so it's not necessarily that people have a difficult time coming up that matters, but how long that stays. So if it stays and they can't get out of it, tendency is that's going to create some psychological distress for them after the experience. But that's, again, I think entirely addressable. But that just explains that state of entropy. So what's happening is normally the way your brain works is it's a little bit rigid. It settles into patterns. And we settle into movement patterns in terms of even our bodies. And we settle into thinking patterns and emotional patterns. And if they get really rigid and deeply entrenched, they can become things like OCD. Or the constant rumination of depression, of anxiety. These are repetitive structures that the brain is repeating the same patterns. PTSD is a classic example of this. And so, which is indicative of simply how the brain works. We fall into these patterns to make sense of an overwhelming array of information and of traumatic experiences, but our thinking patterns can become pathological or not helping us. And I'm not a big fan of putting labels on people, particularly when it comes to consciousness. I think we really need to revisit how we conceive of mental health. There's not enough empirical evidence to justify the diagnostics we work under, to say that the real exist or it helps to diagnose someone with some of these things like depression or anxiety. And they're so widespread and our treatments are relatively ineffectual, it's created what's called the triple crisis in psychiatry. So we need a new model of understanding the brain and of self. So I think what psychedelics do is help us understand that part of how we get out of these deep, rigid thinking patterns of feeling and behavior and cognition is by challenging ourselves. And that can be, I think anybody, entropy can come even if you're like, you have a job and used to doing the same thing every day and then something changes and you have to learn something new. That's good for your brain. And the same way with psychedelics. That's why psychedelics can really be positioned as neurological, educational, beneficial instruments. They help us make us smarter. They get the brain into more of a critical state where it's more alive and responsive. And so what psychedelics can do is these habitual rigid thinking patterns can be disrupted by psychedelics during the effect of the molecule. And as it wears off, what you have is a reset pattern. And this is where Dave Nichols and a lot of his work out of the States really helps us understand the importance of this reset. Because as your neurological patterns of communication under psychedelics get thrown into entropy or what Carhart Harris would call anarchy, the captain on top controlling everything kind of loses control and you have new novel connections. So people can have new ways of experiencing things, new ways of seeing problems, different feelings around past experiences. So it brings us the possibility of the new. And for people to have behavioral change or for therapy to work, they need to experience the state they're trying to get to, somehow some taste of it. So what psychedelics do is give you a time-limited experience of a more critical brain state that allows for different experiences, largely because the way your brain is communicating is radically different. So instead of these rigid communication patterns between the different hubs, and you've probably seen the famous diagram, here's your brain on placebo and here's your brain on psilocybin, and the one on psilocybin has these crazy networks and all this interconnectivity, which is exactly what happens. So your prefrontal cortex, which is the house of your ego, that's the very front of your lobe, you know, the temporal lobe of your front of your kind of cerebral cortex. Your prefrontal cortex is the most recently kind of evolved biologically. It's the seat of higher executive function, but also ego, self-rumination, autobiography. So if we can just, and that's what's overdeveloped in contemporary states, we still have the same brain and body we did, you know, hundreds of thousands of years ago when we lived in nature. So really the pace of technological change has exceeded our body's ability to grow and adapt, which has created all these mental health conditions. So that state of entropy created by psychedelics, really what's happening is parts of your brain are communicating that stopped communicating earlier on due to trauma, cultural reasons, environmental reasons. And the thing that I'm most fascinated about with psychedelics when it comes to the neurochemicals is serotonin. We know these are serotonin agonists. But serotonin itself may be a carryover from earlier photosynthesis days in our genetic evolution, literally coming from the water and coming from the evolution of plant and water. There's a role of serotonin in that. And it's so environmentally cued. So a lot of our internal serotonin levels have to do with a perception of our environment, which then tells us we're not separate, independent, sovereign, rational beings disconnected from our environment. Your very neurochemistry is completely enmeshed in your environment. And that's what serotonin helps us understand. That's what psychedelics help us understand. But neurologically, it really just has to do with disrupting the normative patterns we've settled into. And that's why a lot of people argue, you know, I remember particularly, you know, years ago, it was more of a conversation that, you know, psychedelics seem to do really well for older people. And I think that the clinical trials, part of the bias in them, they tend to be largely white and upper middle class professionals, but also they tend to be older. And because you have so much past autobiographical content as you age, and you kind of aging as part of like the sediment and trying to stay new and fresh and have childlike eyes and that learner's mind, psychedelics can really help people rediscover that. So we know they're also, and this is where it gets super crazy, the newer information coming out of kind of more the kind of basic lab work is that these serotonergic agonists, 5-HT2AR, and how they work, not only do they do something about our prefrontal cortex, but these very chemicals are associated with a very neurogenesis and the neurodevelopment of the prefrontal cortex and of your brain in general. So when we add more of these agonists to, you know, developing brains, they grow faster. So I'm simplifying the research really bluntly here, but it's just to say that there's something about psychedelics. Ayahuasca, this has been proven, it increases your serotonin transporter kind of levels. So you're not just getting like a neuroplasticity in terms of the ability to learn something new, because psychedelics' ability to create neuroplasticity is unbelievably clear, but they may actually create neurogenesis, which is the development of new cellular material in the brain, which is almost unheard of. So that's why, you know, we have a medical officer of health in our company here at Dimensions named DJ Cook, and he's a neuroscientist. And his background is predominantly stroke recovery, traumatic brain injury, brain cancers. We feel intuitively, and we're in the middle of writing kind of a white paper on this, that the application of these serotonergic psychedelics and psilocybin in particular for things like stroke recovery, concussion recovery, traumatic brain injury, early onset Alzheimer's, and the application of other mushrooms for that is clearly emerging as well in terms of lion's mane. That's a whole other realm we've really not got into yet, because we've been so fascinated more with the clinical trials looking at depression, addiction, that kinds of things. But there's a whole other sector. I think it's going to bear a lot of fruit.
Yeah, that's exciting to me. I love that the conversation of psilocybin coming into the human body as not just like a psychotherapeutic thing, but like, you know, something physiologically therapeutic.
Well, if you listen to Francois Bersat's teachings, essentially what she argues is that consciousness is a mushroom. And if you think of it, when you realize this, and if you think about what this experience is to be mushroomed, when you've taken a dose of psilocybin, and I'll get back to your microdosing question in a minute here, but when you take a larger dose and you feel that change in consciousness, if you think about what mushrooms are, they're fruiting bodies that pop up from this underground hidden network of unbelievable intelligence and information sharing, that mycorhizomal network, mycelial network, and that's sharing information and intelligence. So really, mushrooms are the intelligence of the forest. And that's what we're consuming. So they speak to you and they teach you that. So you're being mushroomed and you realize consciousness itself is coming out of this mycelial network, which is maybe this invisible field around us. It's what we're breathing in from the trees around us. It's the energy we're picking up from other people, all the information that's shared. So I really love that notion that consciousness itself is a mushroom. It's a fruiting body. So it pops up out of this underground network, will thrive, will sporulate, and then decay, and then seed the next generation. And that's exactly what life is. We're beings between states. We're between being born and dying, and we're these fruiting bodies, and understanding consciousness in that context really makes us understand how nurtured we are and how connected we are to the world. So those larger doses of mushrooms, I think, help us see that. The microdosing, I have a bit of a different take on microdosing, and the science on microdosing is still early. The jury is out, to be honest. The best book summarizing the kind of neuroscience and the trials and our understanding of microdosing is Torsten Passy's book, The Science of Microdosing, which just came out last year. And I think we have to acknowledge the literature is out. I think people are self-reporting a lot of gains, and I think that has a lot of validity. But when we're trying to really evaluate it, we're not really sure if they have the benefits we hope they do. But I'll tell you my take on it, which is that that's framing it as the wrong problem, which is that, you know, and when I got originally more involved in the mushroom work and field. I obviously did my work to relate to the spirit of the mushroom and used it consciously. And I microdosed for fairly close to a year in different kind of regimes and kind of application kind of schedules. And the thing for me that it did was, it brought me, it's almost like a plant dieta. And if you know people who've done this in the Amazon or go for ayahuasca ceremonies, yep, or, you know, go in and do a dieta and really you're simplifying your diet, you're just getting to know one plant. And there's, you know, dozens of different plants the ayahuasca shamans will use, and people are kind of off on their own in the woods and just maybe eating rice and fish, but, you know, tincture derived from the bark of a tree or a plant, and they're doing that for a month. And so you get this profound understanding of what that molecule is and what it has to say to you. And I think microdosing is the same. It's a bit of a plant teacher. And I think what it does is it gets that molecule into you every day. I think there are neurological benefits, but I think also a lot of people I know who microdose, their dose is higher than subclinical, so they are feeling effects. And what I found is if you got into that just low dose and not microdose, is you really had to be strong in your spiritual practice because you're so sensitive. What these serotonergic agonists do is they really heighten your sensation. So I think if you're doing a low dose of psilocybin or you're microdosing, obviously you want to start by not having to work or going out and just kind of get a sense of how it feels and get to know it. But I think for me, the gain was really, it really developed my spiritual practice because you're implementing on a daily basis. And it helped me understand the spirit of the mushroom a lot better. But I can't, as someone who studies this at this point, to say that microdosing psilocybin is going to have clear neurological or mental health effects based on the molecule. I think it's what you make of it and your relationship to it. And even like Fadiman and Stamets, who have popularized the kind of microdosing schedules, have begun to, you know, change their schedules or say really they're trying to figure it out as well. So we haven't figured out everything, but I would say it's always beneficial to consider putting a natural healing agent into your body on some way that's appropriate for your day. There's not going to be a lot that you lose. I think the only thing that I want to make people aware of is if you chronically microdose and you have any genetic predisposition towards valvular issues in your heart, there is a correlation between chronic microdosing and the potential for having cardiac issues, cardiac arrhythmias, and valvular problems, and that's been established. So I would always encourage people microdosing, take big breaks between, don't do it every day, and just making sure you're not developing tolerance, because if you do take small amounts every day, your body's going to get tolerant, and then you're losing some of the gains. And I think it's more a matter of making sure you have big breaks in between. So generally, people always ask me, you know, like, well, if I'm going to do mushrooms, what's the perfect schedule? And, you know, I think for people to do the larger doses or macro doses with a lot of preparation, good intention, the right setting and the right support, 4 times a year is really good for keeping honest and on practice and learning and taking away tools that then you can integrate. Integration is so important. And then if you're going to microdose, just make sure you're giving yourself good breaks in between doses. If you do it a couple days in a row, give yourself 2, 3, 4, 5 days. Don't microdose all the time. Do it just when you feel you need that relationship and get conscious with the medicine again. And I think that's where the real gains are.
Totally. Yeah, absolutely.
And that's just I'm talking about psilocybin, not all the other wonderful functional mushrooms that you can do lots of things with.
Definitely. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. Well, we unfortunately have to wrap this up. I have a million other questions I would love to ask and keep this conversation going. We have our first in-person team meeting ever, which is
oh awesome. My gosh.
Wow. Yeah, we have a new team that we put
hired
together during
never,
COVID, and we haven't
face.
Yeah, everyone holy I think geez. We have one-on-one meetings with, you know, various people, but we've never had the whole team together. So
that's amazing. Congratulations. Yeah.
All right, fam. Thanks again for tuning in to another super exciting episode of the Mushroom Revival Podcast. Big thanks to Ron Shore for joining us. I personally had an amazing time talking with him and really appreciated his insights into this magical world of mushrooms.
Yeah, great conversation. It's great to know folks like him who have communal values and a keen sense of empathy are on the playing field. Let's keep it up and shoot for the stars.
If you liked what you heard, you can support the show and keep content like this coming by visiting our website, mushroomrevival.com, and purchasing any of our amazing functional mushroom products to support your energy, your focus, sense of calm, your immune system, and even defense against occasional stress, all with the power of functional, amazing mushrooms. And if you're listening to this, podcast listeners get a special surprise discount, a Easter egg, you can call it. If you just enter Pod Treat at checkout, you can uncover what it is. We're not going to tell you how much you're going to save. It could be a really big discount. It could be small. You don't know. We won't tell you.
And it might change.
It might change. We'll switch it up. We'll keep you on your toes. To find out how much you're going to save, you just have to enter PODTREAT, all uppercase letters, at discount to uncover this mushroom Easter egg.
You can also support us by rating and reviewing. This really, really helps. Give us some stars. We like stars. And they really do help keep the podcast running.
Tell your friends about this podcast. Spread the word. Spread the spores. We want everyone to be geeking out and just passionate about mushrooms. So do your part. Spread the spores. And let's have everyone loving mushrooms as much as we do. As always, thanks for tuning in and shrooming in with us. Much love, and may the spores be with you.